TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Farewell to America, Andreas Tupadakis. The Greek chemist made headlines for a few days in early 2000 when he resigned from the nuclear weapons program at Lawrence Livermore Lab and joined the peace movement. Never before had a nuclear scientist resigned at the height of his career. When he was hired under the Stockpile Stewardship Program, Andreas Tupadakis was led to believe that he was helping dismantle nuclear weapons. Once inside Lawrence Livermore Lab, he realized that his colleagues were designing a whole new generation of nuclear weapons under what he calls Manhattan Project No. 2. Andreas Tupadakis started speaking publicly for disarmament. His detailed knowledge about weapons production gave his voice a very rare urgency and authority. He reminded us that still, after the end of the Cold War, nuclear weapons are kept on hair trigger alert, ready to be launched in 30 minutes. In February 2002, he wrote an open letter to the governments of this world. Andreas Tupadakis.
Over 6 billion of people are asking every one of you personally, how is it possible for the whole of humanity and the civilization of thousands of years to be 30 minutes away from extinction at any given moment, gone forever, and you have not weighed properly what is at stake? How can you continue discharging your duties as usual when global death is minutes away? Today, your governments are developing, maintaining, and threatening to use weapons of mass destruction against nations that do not have them. Governments embracing weapons of mass destruction need to understand that there is something much higher at stake than your private vested and national interests are. You derive the right to take the chance of a global catastrophe from nowhere. What you're doing is simply wrestling with an infinitely great. It will be a lost gain for all. More power demands more responsibility, wisdom, and concern for others. Let us abandon all means of war that bring about murder and destruction in the name of national security and self-defense.
That was part of an open letter to world leaders. But Andreas Tupadakis took all this a step further. He did not only ask how we can prevent war by dismantling the weapon systems, but how we could secure peace by changing the way we live. A friend and I visited Andreas 2 days before he was to change his own life in a big way. He returned to Greece, to the island of Crete, where he was born. Andreas Tupadakis, son of a shoemaker from the village of Argyropoulos, who became a world-class nuclear chemist, said farewell to America. He will live again the simple life of his parents, bring home the message of nuclear disarmament, and care for the trees that his grandmother planted for him when he was a boy. I wonder if you would mind to go over one of the reasons why we have this nuclear arsenal.
When you see a nation or nations that they are very well armed to the teeth, and usually the citizens will say from around the world that this country or that country is really powerful because look how many weapons they have. In fact, it is the opposite. Those countries are not powerful. They are extremely weak. They are having the weapons because they are very vulnerable. They have to have the weapons of mass destruction to threaten weaker nations to be able to grab their resources and be able to survive. Since they have created such a social fabric, such social structure with all these conveniences that they require a lot of metals and plastics. The metals come from minerals, the plastics come from petroleum. All these machines and conveniences we have, this artificial mode of life we live in, they really come from the ground, resources, oil and minerals. And when we have such a desire to use them to such an extent we use them, we don't have enough. We need to take them from other parts of the world, wherever they are, and in order to accomplish that, we need to have a lot of military power to threaten, push out, conquer, grab these resources from weaker nations that they don't have the military that we have. And so I believe that the car is probably the greatest problem we have in our millennium.
When did you first get inspired to think about automobiles?
I think I start thinking about the pollution years ago, but I think the oil problem connected to the car, only lately I really deeply believed it and understood it, that if we have any nuclear holocaust in the future, it will be because of the car. It is going to be a friction between East and West, who is going to grab the oil. And if people do not give it up the car, which most people think that it's crazy to even talk about it, but if they don't really give up the car to go to a simple life community like in the past, the car will destroy the world by inviting a nuclear holocaust, friction between East and West. Or if it doesn't that way go, it will go by altering the climate. We already know that the reports the scientists have written down, they're talking about an irreversible, sudden, and complete destruction of the Earth because of the climate change. So either way, pollution or war is coming up because of the car, because of the way we have decided to live our lives. We think it's convenient, but it's not going to last for too long. I do believe there's a great number of people around the world, in every country almost, that they have this vision of simple life communities. There are some of them around, but not many. But I think this number of simple living communities are going to increase to a tremendous degree as the days go by and people are going to get more suppressed by the world economic and social system. And they will go and make their living by gardening and give up most of the conveniences that we take for granted right now. And we do not know what they're doing to us, really.
You're planning to do some walking when you land in Greece, right?
Right. Oh, what I want to do is I want to go around the country from village to village and city to city and college campus to college campus and island to island and bring awareness to the people about the things that we're talking about here, about simple life living. And then I want to end up where my ancestors were, where their sweat is still on the soil, and let my sweat also go into that same soil and become fertilizer for the beautiful things that the land will give me back by working on it. And I believe quite a few people are going to join me, not just from my country, Greece, my native country, but also from other countries. I believe there will be people coming, and I do believe they will stay, some people for a short time, some people for a long time, but I would like to see them going back to their own places and bring this vision to their own countries and to their own communities.
Where on Crete did your ancestors live?
The village that I come from, and there's some land there already from my ancestors, is called Argyropolis. In English, you would call it probably Silver City. But it's about 20 minutes from Rethymno in Crete, the western part of Crete. I know there are already people there from my childhood, friends and relatives, that they would be very glad to see me there and help me to start. But it's easier to have friends or relatives because this matter is a matter of the spirit, not a matter of blood. It has to do with the desire to serve others and to not hurt the environment and the people. I believe this whole social structure in a house is disrupted, and that starts all from physical pollution, which also comes from our wrong way of visualizing what life is all about, and walk away from this fast lane, polluting way of doing things, and have time to drink a glass of wine and spend time with our friends in the backyard and the kitchen table. This world is going completely out of sanity. Why were we going to follow this? We don't need to follow that. And there is always a choice. I think if people get together, one by one cannot do it. I believe this has to be done as a community. Two friends, three friends, one family, two families, three families. It can only be accomplished when people surrender themselves selfishness, not to be selfish, to get together and do it together. There is no way one person can do it by himself.
Oh, tell me about your grandmother.
She was the inspiration for me, in fact. Probably I would never be able to do what I plan to do and what I have done so far to be able to get out of the fast lane and become content if I would not remember that's her actions and her life was a big part in my life. Well, every day she was working every day from the sunrise to the sun going down in the field. We had different properties of vineyards and gardens and olive groves, and she would be every day in a different place, fertilizing from the droppings of the animals and tilling the ground to cutting, doing everything you can imagine, having animals, all kinds of animals. I lived in that kind of life, and I remember her characteristically when she would come down from the mountain with a basket with grapes on her shoulder, going down to the house. I was with her, and I remember when she would reach the house, the basket would be empty of grapes, and my grandfather would say, "What happened, Vajelitsa, was her name? What happened again?" And she said, "Don't worry, I will go tomorrow again, I'll get more grapes." The reason the basket was empty was because she would stop in every balcony, under balcony, on every doorstep that people were sitting outside and give them grapes because not many people had vineyards. So all this love of her, it never left me, and I always remember it. And in fact, whenever I take my family and go for vacation all these years, 20 years we have been in America, I remember many people in the village were bringing us all kinds of different things, like milk and rapids and kitchens and eggs and butter. And my children would sometimes ask why they do that. And I would tell them they remember my grandmother's love, and they want to show their gratitude towards my grandparents because they were generous. So look what happened now. And that's why I'm telling my children today, because sometimes they ask me, "How are you going to do it by yourself? You have nothing." And I told them that the love of my grandparents and the trust I have in them, to the people that are now there, that trust I have in them, I trust their goodness, I trust their humanity, I trust their love, I trust this that will help me to make the start, to do it together, to become a member of their community again. And I don't have any doubt that this is going to succeed, because it's based on trust and love, which is the greatest power in the universe.
When did she die?
She died when I was an undergraduate student in chemistry department in Salonika, 1976, around that time. She loved me a lot. It's very funny because she was struggling with cancer, and she would not go away until she was saying, "I want to see Andreas Kamp from the university from Salonika, North Greece." And I remember the day I went, the next day, it was a Christmas day, and she departed. But she left me instructions when she died, and I think that was very powerful to me. She said, "The trees I put for you, I put them to remember me and to feed you." So now that I have been going for years and I see them drying and dying, I really lately felt that I have followed my own way, which is the wrong way, and I felt like I need to go back and prune them and restore them and come back and feed me instead of working in the corporate world, lying and having two faces to be able to make ends meet. I can be pure in my conscience and free when I go to sleep, knowing that I don't do anything wrong and I don't write any secrecy agreements or lying to people. That will be life for me. And if my family would like to join me in the same environment, the village, they can do it. Otherwise, they can be near in a city 20 minutes from there and do their own thing. But they will have the choice to do whatever they please.
I was curious to ask you what kinds of trees your grandmother planted for you.
Plum trees, which after you dry them, you can eat them all winter long. Fig trees and olive trees. These trees are eternal. There was no one day not to be with nature, and I think that's the dangerous thing. People, they are in the Pentagon and in the White House and in the governments of the big countries. I think these people have lost touch with the earth, and it's very dangerous because when you lose touch with the earth, you will destroy it without even knowing it because you don't think it's important. You don't think it's you need it. And unless we have people more to go with the earth and require, actually, demand from our leaders, the politicians, to really spend some years of their life working with the land, we will not see any better days, because democracy in ancient Athens was not people all their life to be politicians and never do any manual work but be in offices. It was people from the city that they were farmers, shepherds, and they would take 1 or 2 or 3 years, 5 years, whatever they were taking, a small number of years, serve the city of Athens, and then going back again to be farmers and shepherds. They were not a job as a politician all of their lives. And so we have completely distorted the meaning of democracy, because that was a democracy in Athens. It was not the way we do it today. You know, get a degree from Harvard and be a politician all your life and never put your hand in, on a tree or on the land. When you buy figs from a supermarket shelf, what you try to protect is the supermarket. You say, I have to give my money to the corporations to support and sustain the supermarket because that gives me the figs. But you don't realize it's not the supermarket, it's the fig tree. And so, and unless you really go back to the village life and the simple life and you tame a fig tree and you fertilize it with the manure, you know, you prune it or whatever, you water it, and you really treat it like a baby and you hug it. You feel it like it's your own life. If you don't do that, then you cannot appreciate when you eat a fig tree that it's when you eat a fig, you cannot appreciate the importance of the fig tree. When you know that the fig came from the fig tree, then you will do everything possible to sustain that goat or fig tree, because you know that's your life, that's your resource. You lose that, you lose your life, you're dead. Even the European Union is playing the people in Greece yo-yo. In other words, what I mean by that is one year they tell them to plant olive trees. After 5 years or 3 years, they tell them cut them down and put now vineyards. And they play all these gimmicks to make money, to play the politics in economics. And they don't leave the people alone. They have to have a number for every animal. They have to completely control the number of the animals and how they will do it and how they will raise them, how they will feed them. It's incredible what's taking place. They think that the people, the farmers and the shepherds are like puppets, and they try to tell them what to do, a complete control. And it's because people have lost trust one another. They trust the European Union to give them money to be able to do it, and they have isolated themselves from one another. But I believe that after they hear a message like this one, they will be inspired. And if not all, most of them, or anyway, some of them, will come out of this isolation mechanism, and they will come together and trust one another, help one another, love one another, and they will start communities to be able to support local production and local consumption, instead of having planes from one point of the earth going to the other point of the earth to bring the produce, which is completely senseless. Why do we have to have grapes from the other side of the earth, bring them by plane, consuming all these incredible resources and polluting the earth, when we can eat pears or watermelon? We don't have to have everything now. Let's wait for 6 months to get them in the summer. So this is very basic things we need to change, our way of thinking and demanding. We can live so nicely if we really put priorities in place.
And you, as a young boy, you did see that still functioning, a local economy.
Absolutely. I saw it in my first 8 years of my life. That was a kingdom on earth. There was not even one car in my village. There was only one or two buses that they were taking the people to this big city, but nobody had a car. I don't even remember the first years, 5 years, electricity. And people were so happy. They were singing, and every night you would hear in the village, in every bar or every cafe store, you know, they were dancing and drinking wine and singing and playing organs. They were much different. And even today in Greece is very different. And the vineyards were green, the houses were maintained, the people were on the streets, there was life. Now everything is like a cemetery, and it's happening all over the world, and that's exactly what happened in India when the British went there and took the resources and put their people the way they wanted, and everything disappeared. It's happening all over the world. The beautiful life that people had, they believed the lies of the corporations and the powerful people, and they were brought into the big cities, and they became slaves into the factories, and now they're entangled into these traps. But they always have the choice to come out, and that's what I want to see. I want to see more people doing it, and then people will get encouraged, you know, to see, you know, they can say, you know, if this person can do it, why not me? That's exactly what I thought. I read books, I saw people that had done it, and I said, Andreas, why do you have to be in this pit? If this person did it, he's no different than you, so you can do it. And well, I did it, and I'm doing it. So that's exactly what I want people to hear, that if I can do it and other people can do it, they can do it too. I can tell you a story. When I was a little boy in Rethymno, there was a store that I used to buy candies and nuts. And it was burned. One day, suddenly, there was a fire and was flattened. And on the radio, I heard that they had an account number in a bank, so everybody who wanted to help, he could help that way. And my father was a shoemaker. He was a poor man. We would just make ends meet. We didn't have any extra. But he said, Andreas, this money we'll take from this box, from his drawer, he said, we'll put in that box, and at night, after my work, whenever, in the afternoon, we would go to the bank and give this money for Mr. Simidzis. That was his name. The story is that after about a month or 2 months, something like that, they could restore, built his store all the way up, even better than it was before it was burned, by the donation of loving people of the city. No insurance was involved, nothing. And that was one thing that I never forgot. And this is like we can do it again. We do not need to rely on this illusionary mechanism and institutions that the only thing they have done is to isolate the people and to be afraid of one another, which brings violence, and to give the power to institutions that they are led by people that we don't even know who they are and what they plan to do and what they're doing. It's absolutely insane. We're doing this to ourselves. The loan concept, I believe the loan is one of the worst things that could happen in humanity. The loans, the retirement plans, the insurances, all these things, all these mechanisms are the most destructive institutions that could have been invented in humanity. Many intellectuals consider them the best invention in humanity as civilization, but I'm convinced in my heart that it is has come from minds that they were not trusting the goodness in humanity. They were not trusting the beautiful hearts, the beautiful seeds, the beauty that there is in every person's heart. They were people frightened and insecure, the ones that they invented this kind of institutions and mechanisms, and unfortunately they drew humanity to themselves, and that's why we see what we see. We have no control of our money when we give them to these institutions, what they use them for.
The money. Buy Enron stock, maybe.
Yes, that's one example, but that's probably the tip of the iceberg. Well, not probably, we're sure. This is the tip of the iceberg. What has happened around the world in every country is hard to imagine. People are using the money of stocks and savings to making weapons, to all kinds of things that people would never vote. Let's do it, because if they knew what they would be doing with their money, they would never, ever say, we vote for this. When your money go out of your pocket and you don't know who has them, you know what corporation has them, but you don't know what they're doing with them, then you should not be surprised if you lose them.
It's good to hear you speak like this, because even though your plans for your life are very specific to you, what they share with many others is to restore local life, because even if you don't have a spiritual quest, it's the antidote to globalization.
Right. Right. What is happening to a lot of people, intellectuals and professors at universities and government officials, people that they are eminent, people know about them, they're pretty well known, and they have positions of authority and power. They are advocates of a one world government. That's not a secret. They call it New World Order. They call it one world government. And I believe it is a fatal mistake to erase the borders of the nations, kill the traditions and the indigenous customs and religions, whatever it is that supports an indigenous society. I think it's suicidal to do it. And the reason I'm saying this is that unless you abolish not just the weapons of mass destruction, not just the weapons in general, But even the institution of war, if we do not abolish these things first, and we try to abolish the love for our indigenous cultures, then what we're creating is a global dictatorship. Absolutely, there is no possibility to have a peaceful one world village, as many people call it, when you have strong nations holding still nuclear weapons in their arsenals. It's going to be a humanity oppressed, and globalization without borders and diminishing all this indigenous kind of life will bring global dictatorship. So in order not to have this tragic situation, which is unthinkable to think about, because we have seen in the past what happened, is to support the indigenous cultures, to support the indigenous traditions, the languages, the everything that has to do with indigenous life. And I appeal to people in the governments, because I do believe in every government of every nation, there are leaders that they are very humane and they have a loving heart and a light in their hearts. And I appeal to them that the time has come that they must stand up. And when they see that they cannot affect a change in their governments and their nations, they should vocally depart, resign, and condemn what the wrong is happening. They should not stay and say, I'm trying my best. When we see these kind of changes that people sacrifice their positions, their fame, their names, their salaries, and they walk away and they say, not with my consent. There is no way, a question in my mind, that from 400 people in the Congress, there was only Barbara Lee that did not want war. I do believe most of them, they didn't want war, but they were misled and they did not have the courage to stand up. They need to have the courage. They need to stand up and they need to defend their families, their nation in a good way, not the violent way, because violence brings violence.
That was the nuclear chemist Andreas Tupadakis, who resigned in early 2000 from his job at Lawrence Livermore Lab. 2 days after the interview, he said farewell to America and returned to Greece, where he was born. He now lives a simple life in the small village of Argyropoulos, where his father was a shoemaker. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on Andreas Tupadakis on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order is welcome. It allows us to continue our work. Call us toll-free anytime at 1-877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.